Hello, this is Chris with the Bloomington Pentagraph for Monday, June 30th. We'll begin today's reading on the front page. Soil protection efforts run dry. Budget cuts squeeze staffing as loose soil whips up dust storms from Springfield. Three main factors contribute to the formation of Midwest dust storms: strong winds, dry soil in farm fields, and large amounts of loose soil. That's according to Andy Taylor, the Science and Operations Officer at the National Weather Service's office in Lincoln. He said these are key ingredients that meteorologists, farmers, and experts in the agricultural community have found cause dust storms when they converge. On May 16th, Chicago saw its first major dust storm since the Dust Bowl, which stretched from Texas to New York in the early 1930s and deposited 300 million tons of soil across the nation, 12 million tons of which settled in the Chicago region, according to the Bill of Rights Institute. The storm in May dropped visibility in the city to near zero as wind gusts blew over 60 miles per hour at times, according to the National Weather Service. Taylor said the atmospheric environment that day was more characteristic of the dry environments in the high plains or the southwest U.S., not the Midwest. As rain began to fall near Bloomington, it quickly evaporated and cooled the atmosphere, creating strong pockets of wind that began to move north. And as winds sped up, the storm began to pick up and move dry and loose soil from fields it passed over, which created the dust storm. The type of dust storm event that we had that affected the Chicago area, I wouldn't necessarily take that occurrence as saying we're going to see an increase in those type of events from this point on, he said. Although anytime you see all those ingredients come together, we certainly could see that again. While there were no deaths due to the recent storm in Chicago, in May 2023, a major dust storm on a portion of Interstate 55 in central Illinois resulted in a multi-car pileup that took the lives of 8 people and injured dozens more. That dust storm also dropped visibility to zero on the stretch of the interstate between Farmersville and DeVerdon and was again caused by dry, loose soil being picked up and moved by winds. Although Taylor said dust storms are not new to Illinois, as his office has documented events back to the 1980s, most of the storms don't move across vast expanses of the state. Instead, he said they often occur in more localized areas like the storm near DeVerdon in 2023. When we're seeing the right weather-related factors coming together and the ground is fairly dry, which matches up with loose soil, so we know we're going to be more prone to blowing dust, we coordinate with partners in the agricultural community to determine when we might anticipate those blowing dust events. The Association of Illinois Soil and Water Conservation Districts has been lobbying for increased funding for additional district employees. This year's state budget allows for each district to staff one full-time employee, which AISWCD Executive Director Elliot Clay called wildly inadequate, as he said each district needs at least two. I really honestly think conservation funding has been deprioritized. Soil and water conservation districts began to crop up across the U.S. in the late 1930s as a response to the Dust Bowl and Congress's subsequent declaration of soil and water conservation as a national priority. According to the Association of Illinois Soil and Water Conservation Districts, that declaration prompted then-President Franklin Roosevelt, to recommend legislation to state lawmakers that would enact districts in every state. Illinois has 97 districts, or nearly one district for every county in the state. Employees of the districts are responsible for a variety of tasks, including assessing farmland, educating farmers about conservation practices, and connecting farmers with grants from the state and federal government. These all play a key role in the association's mission of protecting Illinois' natural resources. Unlike a group like the Department of Natural Resources or the EPA, or even the Department of Agriculture, SWCDs are not a regulatory body, Clay said. We are not going out there and enforcing rules and laws on people. We're just trying to help farmers do better. And that's the reason why a lot of farmers rely on SWCDs, is because they do not see us like the government coming in and telling them, this is how you're going to do your operation. The fiscal year 2026 budget signed by Governor Pritzker last week allots $7.5 million to the state's SWCDs. That's a $1 million overall cut from the previous year, although funding for operations remained level. Funding had already been cut by $4 million total in fiscal year 2025. Of the $7.5 million, $3 million will go to cost-share grants, which act as reimbursements to farmers for the cost of implementing both state and federal conservation policies, such as cover crops. The remaining $4.5 million will go to administrative costs. Clay said the breakdown of that $4.5 million provides $40,000 to each soil and water conservation district, meaning every district will have enough funds to pay one full-time employee. He called the salary wildly inadequate for the district employees, most of whom have college degrees. $40,000, and that's supposed to include benefits, so their take-home is less than that, is barely enough. I mean, I would say it's not even enough for one person. And it's hard to keep people and incentivize people to come to work when there's not that kind of money there that there should be. In addition, Clay said each district needs two full-time employees to be fully staffed, one to make on-site visits to farms and one to coordinate schedules, receive phone calls and emails, and staff the office. He said in recent years, the association was told by both the Department of Agriculture and the governor's office that they wanted more funding. They would have to advocate for the money to individual lawmakers outside of budget negotiations. I don't know of any other agency or subsect of an agency that has to, on their own, go to the Capitol and get money. That's very peculiar to me and is something I've been trying to wrap my head around, and I have not gotten a good explanation from anybody. The governor's office did not respond to a request for comment. Over the past 2 years, Clay said the association unsuccessfully lobbied for $10.5 million in annual funding. The bigger question I'm left with after being the executive director over the past 6 months and witnessing it from this angle is, what does the legislature and the administration value? It really gets to bigger questions about how the state has dealt with conservation funding in general for the last 20-plus years. Kevin Brooks, a commercial agriculture educator at the University of Illinois Urbana-Champaign, said the agriculture community has identified practices farmers can use to reduce the amount of dry, loose topsoil in their fields. Measuring the humidity level as a cause is not the issue, Brooks said in an interview with the Capital News Illinois. I won't say it's not 100% not about the weather, but this is primarily about tillage. One suggestion he made was for farmers to till their fields less frequently and instead resort to strip tilling or using no-till strategies, whenever possible, to reduce the amount of loose topsoil in fields. Strip till is a tilling practice where only narrow rows of a field where seeds will be planted are tilled, leaving the rest of the field untouched. While there are many short and long-term benefits to strip tilling, no-till practices often don't seem to benefit farmers right away, but do often have long-term advantages. Representative Charles Meyer farms 1,500 acres in southern Illinois with his family, including corn, wheat, beans, hay, and beef cattle. He said most crops are already minimally tilled by farmers. I'm 66 years old, and we never no-tilled when I was a kid, he told CNI. All of our conventional soybeans are no-tilled now. All of our wheat is done by minimal till, and our corn is all by minimal till now. He said he's in frequent contact with his SWCD, including a call on June 23rd with his district's employee, and criticized Democratic leadership's funding priorities, such as subsidies for renewable energy. They're not funding the nuts and bolts of Illinois conservation. I'm not against wind and solar, but they don't pay for themselves, and they're making us taxpayers pay for them. Another main practice Brooks recommended farmers employ was planting cover crops, which are crops planted after harvest, not for their produce, but for their benefits to the soil. Cover crops can be planted after a fall harvest for a variety of benefits, including to preserve topsoil through the winter, increase organic matter in the soil, and dry the fields earlier in the spring. Brooks also attributed recent dust storms to the invention of high-speed discs, a tillage attachment with many more discs than normal tillage attachments, which tills at at faster rates. He said these discs have taken tillage speeds from around 4 miles per hour to over 10, and that farmers in Illinois quickly amassed these machines during and after the COVID pandemic due to the pandemic relief funds they received. In theory, they're supposed to be a kind of conservation because they don't go into the ground very deep, but they literally turn the top several inches of a farm field into a powder. Andy Taylor from the National Weather Service recommended safety tips for drivers who find themselves caught in a dust storm. If you're caught in a dust with extremely low visibility, the advice is to pull completely off the road, turn off your heads, and take your foot off the brake, which may sound kind of counterintuitive in a way, but the reason for doing that is because if you have your lights on, people coming into the dust may think you're moving. They may see your taillights and think, oh, look, someone I can follow, and that may exacerbate accidents and pileups. He also advised drivers who know there is a risk of a potential dust storm to travel ahead of the storm or to delay travel until later in the day if possible. Connect Go preparing for July 1st launch. Connect Transit to roll out new service in rural McLean County from Bloomington. Starting Tuesday, Connect Transit will begin offering bus trips starting and or ending in rural McLean County, courtesy of its new transit service, Connect Go. The door-to-door service will be open to any rural McLean County resident. Hours of operation will be from 8 to 5 p.m., Monday through Friday, and reservations must be made by noon, 1 to 3 weekdays in advance. For now, there is no charge for the service. David Brown, Managing Director of Connect Transit, said staff have prepared for rural transportation through the use of a scheduling system that arranged passenger trips and communicated with the drivers via a tablet on board each vehicle. So between our communication system, our tablet, and the onboard cameras, we think that we have it all settled. So it seems to be working well. Brown added that it will take a few months to understand the overall demand for the service. Once that happens, Connect Transit hopes to propose additional services to the McLean County Board. I think that we really just need to get an understanding of what people want and where people want to go, Brown said. Unfortunately, there might be some challenges meeting all the demand that they have, but we will be capturing all the requests for service and then making service adjustments as we go along. McLean County had been in business with its previous provider, Showbus, since 1979. But last year, the McLean County Executive Committee recommended a resolution notifying all affected parties about the county's intent to withdraw from its agreement with Showbus. This decision not only affected rural McLean County residents, but also residents of DeWitt, Ford, Iroquois, Livingston, and Macon counties. In May, the McLean County Board approved an intergovernmental agreement transferring ownership and operational control of its rural transportation service program, as well as its service vehicles and equipment, to Connect Transit. Jennifer Six, transportation planner for the McLean County Regional Planning Commission, said Showbus will continue its services in Livingston and Iroquois counties and has signed a separate agreement with the Illinois Department of Transportation's Office of Intermodal Project Implementation for Services in Kankakee, Logan, and Mason counties. Ford County is transitioning to a rural public transit service out of Vermilion County, but Six said she can't confirm the status of rural transit services in DeWitt and Macon counties. Subscription trips will not be offered by ConnectGo, therefore residents will need to call in every day for the trip that they need. Brown recommended passengers who use the county's previous rural transit system to call ConnectGo at 309-828-9833 to make sure they are in the new system and there won't be a disruption of service. And in a sidebar, ConnectGo passenger information trips are available from 8 a.m. to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday, with final pickups taking place at 4 p.m. To reserve a ride, call 309-828-9833 one day to 3 days in advance. Weekend service or reservations during weekend hours are not available at this time. Service is based on a first-come, first-served basis with limited availability. Cancellations must be made at least 2 hours in advance. And for more information, go online. And from Bloomington, clubs, game nights foster community. For the past 3 years, Red Raccoon Games in downtown Bloomington has partnered with the Prairie Pride Coalition to host Gamers Night every third Saturday of the month. The store closes at 7 p.m., but attendees are welcome to stay afterward and enjoy some board games and community, said Ariel Fogel, the store's event coordinator. It's just kind of a community gamers night where we close the upstairs to the shop. Usually Prairie Pride Coalition orders pizza, and we have soft drinks and everything, she said. According to the store's website, anyone who identifies as LGBTQ is welcome to come out and enjoy this night full of games, food, and fun with people like you. Red Raccoon is just one of several places in the Twin Cities creating a space where members of the LGBTQ plus community can feel safe, welcomed, and celebrated. Prairie Pride Coalition has a business and resource directory on its website that contains a myriad of businesses and organizations that are friendly to the LGBTQ plus community. While Normal Public Library's main building has been closed for nearly a year due to renovations, when it reopens, the front doors will have a sticker marking the library as being on Prairie Pride Coalition's list, said Laura Golwinski, NPL's patron experience manager. So people immediately know when they walk in that we have committed to the requirements to be part of that directory, which are being an open, welcoming place for all, and to actively encourage engagement with materials by people from that community. The library has regular monthly challenges and events featuring LGBTQ plus books and authors for adults and children alike, said Rhiannon Schautz, the library's programming and youth services manager. For the past several years, the Bloomington and Normal Public Libraries have coordinated with Prairie Pride Coalition for Pride in the Park. This year on July 9th, they will host a Pride Night at Miller Park Zoo from 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. This will be our fourth event, and it's always, I think, had great reception and people are thankful for it. And they come dressed up and they're wearing their flags, and it's just another space where they can be themselves, said Molly Stevenson, a reference librarian at the Bloomington Public Library. BPL has a book club called True Colors that meets quarterly and welcomes adults who are LGBTQ and their friends, families, and allies to explore queer literature. Reading a queer book doesn't mean they're going to have an epiphany and discover that they're gay overnight, but they might, or at least they might understand someone in their life a little bit better. BPL's teen librarian, Tiffany Siebert, oversees the teen zone in the library and has a Pride book club there as well, something that is helpful for teens, especially at that age, especially when people might be discovering things about themselves. Much like libraries, bookstores can be a welcome refuge for people seeking community. It really brings me a sense of purpose, says Liz Asbury, owner of Bob's Bay Books. It brings me a sense of joy to be able to have a space that people feel comfortable in. It seems like an extension of my home. While BuzzBay is a business, Asbury says she wants the store to feel more than just a place to spend money. I want a place that people feel safe, people feel welcomed. I know we are a bookstore where our content is to sell things, but it's more than that. The sentiment is shared on the other side of Main Street at longtime LGBTQ hangout, the Bistro, said Leslie Adams, a patron of the business and friend of the owner. It's not all about just being the bar, even when you're at the bar. For the past handful of years, Adams has coordinated the Bistro Book Club and Bistro Fam Kickball. I had a friend who last year met her current partner in the cheering section of our kickball games. To be able to facilitate and provide that space for people to be their authentic selves, I don't even know if you can really put words to it, Adams said. It's beautiful, and that is what our community is. Fogel, from Red Raccoon, grew up south of Bloomington Normal and graduated from high school in 2008. Though that is not the distant past, it was still difficult to grow up as a member of the LGBTQ community, she said. You could not be gay in high school in 2004 to 2008, Fogel said. That was not something, not in rural Illinois, that was a thing. Fogel is bisexual, so she knows how difficult it can be to find a place that is welcoming for people who do not identify as straight or cisgender. It wasn't until she came to college at Illinois State University that she found that space. That was my first time seeing an actual Pride group, and I had a great time. I joined them as a historian for the Pride group for a little bit and photographer. It was a great time. A lifelong Bloomington resident, Stevenson, who is lesbian, has seen firsthand how accepting McLean County has become. I didn't come out until I was 22, she said. I was very late to the game. It seems like there kind of hit a time when it went from more taboo to less, like just the explosion of knowledge and internet and all of that. The Twin Cities are now a very welcoming community. In general, I think that most people of the LGBTQ community, myself included, would say that Bloomington is a safe space and there are different opportunities for you to just be yourself. You don't even have to think twice about it. The shift toward inclusivity was massive, said Asbury, herself a lifelong Bloomingtonian. It has become so much more welcoming and accepting and just open arms to anybody that's decided to move here. In fact, the Twin Cities have become a beacon for people seeking refuge and community. I like this little bastion for the LGBTQ community in central Illinois. Bloomington Normal is fantastic. And in a sidebar, if you go, Gamers Night, every third Saturday of the month at Red Raccoon Games, 301 North Main Street in Bloomington, $5 event cost, waived with a table-free coupon. Bistro Book Club, first and third Wednesday of the month at the Bistro, 316 North Main Street in Bloomington. Time varies. See Facebook page for details. Bistro Fam Kickball, 6 p.m. on the second and fourth Wednesdays of the month at the Boys and Girls Club of Bloomington Normal, 1615 Illinois Street. And Pride Night at Miller Park Zoo, 5:30 to 7:30 p.m. Wednesday, July 9th at Miller Park Zoo, 1020 South Morris Avenue in Bloomington. And from the local page, 200-year bash. Saybrook founders' descendants return for reenactments at festival. From Saybrook, 200 years ago, Jonathan Chaney and his wife Catherine founded a little village called Chaney's Grove, what is today known as Saybrook. This past weekend, the village commemorated the occasion with the Stars and Stripes Bicentennial Festival, which included vendors, fresh kettle corn, family-friendly entertainment, and live music, said Brian Haig, vice president and treasurer of the Saybrook Community Days organization. We've got activities for kids, we've got a ride-on train, bubble cannon, a foam machine, all that stuff. During the celebration, around 20 of the Chaney's descendants returned to the village their ancestors founded. Some of those 20 even dressed up as their ancestors in historical reenactment at Riverside Cemetery, including Christopher Chaney playing William Haynes Chaney. There were connections between the Cheneys and the Lincolns in his early lawyer days, Christopher Cheney said, and so Haynes was on the delegations that went to the convention in Chicago to nominate Lincoln for president. The Cheney connection to famous presidents goes even further back to the Revolutionary War. Jonathan Cheney's grandfather was the second man killed at Bunker Hill, but that man's sons would survive and fight under one General George Washington of the Continental Army. Our family to have a relationship with both Washington and Lincoln is fascinating. The process of connecting the Cheneys to Saybrook was serendipitous for Tracy Cheney, who resides in Los Angeles, was researching family lore, separating fact from fiction, and realized the 200th anniversary of Cheney's Grove was approaching. I found a Facebook page for the local government, contacted the mayor saying, "Are you guys doing anything?" She was put in touch with Ann Young, a lifelong Saybrook resident who planned the cemetery walk. Tracy Cheney and I shared some of the history through emails. She wrote some of the stuff for the souvenir book, Young said. They said they'd come out and act out their ancestors, so it's a great thing. The cemetery walk also included other historical figures like Gilbert Bates, known for his peaceful marches in the South following the Civil War. We have two doctors, one of whom shot the other one and killed him, and we have a pioneer couple that started the first grist mill used to grind grain into flour. And, of course, Jonathan and Catherine Cheney were present as well, played by two of their great-great-grandchildren. Catherine was played by Lois Zell, and Jonathan was played by Jonathan Cheney, the patriarch's modern-day namesake. It was important for the family to come help Saybrook celebrate, Tracy Cheney said, because they had not been to the village's celebrations for over 50 years. They hadn't had a Cheney at an event. They didn't have one of their 175th in 2000 or their 150th. "I'm going," and about 20 of us said, "Yeah, we're going to go too." Residents were more than happy and some emotional to celebrate their small town. Hang, who originally from eastern Kentucky, called himself an import. "Small towns are where it's at for me. The sense of camaraderie and teamwork and just togetherness is much stronger in communities of this size." Even though she lives outside the village proper, Young still thinks Saybrook is a fine place for families. "It was a great place to grow up," she said. "There were a lot more businesses when I was a child, a lot more going on then, but it's still a pretty little town with good people. It's a great place for kids to be, learn, to grow up, and be free and run around." Events planned for Sunday included a breakfast at the American Legion, a 5K, and church service at Saybrook Park, a parade at 11:30 a.m., and a full day of live music, kids' activities, and craft and flea market, food vendors, and more. The day was slated to conclude with fireworks at dusk. For more information and a complete events lineup, go to Facebook and look up Saybrook Stars and Stripes. And from Idaho, authorities in western Idaho urged residents to shelter in place Sunday afternoon following a shooting in Kenai County near Coeur d'Alene. Governor Brad Little said on the social platform X that multiple firefighters were attacked while responding to a blaze. At least two people were killed. We'll take a short break now and return with the second half hour of the Bloomington Pentagraph for Monday, June 30th. Please stay tuned.